Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Chris Shores from Boston, Massachusetts, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
So thank you, Chris, for introducing the Tennis Podcast, our second edition here from the Australian Open in Melbourne. And you can do the same. You haven't got much time left in order to do so. We have about 40 hours left as we come to you from Garden Square in Melbourne Park here before our Kickstarter closes for another year. So if you want to support the show, we have reached our target. So, you know, we understand if you feel, well, job done, we'll maybe pitch in next year. But if you want to be one of the many that and support the show throughout the year, it won't go to waste. All of it will be going towards helping us to produce this show and just making it easier for us to do so. So thank you to everybody who has. Matt Roberts is here. I'm here, David Law. And you will notice once again that Catherine Whittaker is not. However,
good news.
Good news is here, folks, because she's been for her eye test and she's been given the green light. Or at least that's what she's telling us. She might have been told, actually, you probably shouldn't go. But
She's just coming anyway.
She's coming anyway. We know for a fact, as things stand at the very least, Catherine is due to board a flight tomorrow, Sunday, and will get here, if all goes according to plan, just when we start our Monday night first day's play edition of the Daily Tennis Podcast. So fingers crossed, but great news. We're chuffed. As you can imagine, Catherine is too. But it's been lovely, the reaction everybody's given out there. All of you, so many people have been getting in touch to wish her all the best. And it's worked, because all that positive energy
yes,
has caused the recovery, partially at least, of Catherine Whittaker. So long may that continue.
Yes, she broke the news via a video diary, which is a new thing this year that she's hoping to do, the first of which not in Melbourne, but at Moorsfields Eye Hospital. I mean, I'm not sure we'll ever be forgetting that. That'll be something we look back on and think, did that happen?
Is that the new Putney Exchange? Maybe
yeah,
not. Okay.
Catherine did say it's been her second home in the last week.
Yeah, not been a great deal of fun for her. But no. Anyway, thankfully it looks like she's coming and she'll be with us for most of the fortnight. We are here today to talk about the day that we've just had. It's about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, local time. In terms of the weather conditions, I'll just update you. It's been another pretty clear day, hasn't it? It's been quite warm throughout most of it, but we're under cloudy skies at the moment. White clouds, nothing unpleasant. It's quite breezy, quite warm air, but the air has generally been clear. But it has been a huge topic of conversation in the press conferences that Matt and I have attended today. And just to give you an idea of what this place is like on the Saturday before the Australian Open, it is effectively media day. That's what they call it. And they give us a sheet of paper. They send out an email at the start of the day listing all the players that are coming in. And from a period of about 11:30 in the morning right through to 5 o'clock in the afternoon, back to back, the biggest names in the world come into the interview room. I think there are maybe two recognisable ones that haven't been in today. Certainly one of those, Novak Djokovic, will be in tomorrow, which is great for us because that gives us something else to talk about tomorrow and all the media. And Serena Williams was notable by her absence today as well.
And also Ash Barty, who is in tomorrow. Obviously, she's still playing in in Adelaide. Yeah. So she's in the interview room tomorrow.
But we have had today Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal. We've had Stefanos Tsitsipas, Dominic Thiem, Naomi Osaka, Caroline Wozniacki. Matt and I have been giving ourselves cramp by just sitting in the third row of the interview room and not moving at all.
Yes, if we're allowed to have a good day without Catherine, I think today was it.
Yes.
We did enjoy the day just sitting in the third row like naughty schoolboys, trying not to find it all too funny. And you know, we were kind of commenting after each press conference, giving our take on it just between ourselves. And now we're going to share what we found out. I should say on the weather front that it had been expected to be a lot worse over this weekend. Simon Briggs was telling us yesterday that the reading was expected to go up above 200, which is the threshold for when it will become not playable. And yet, thankfully, it's been down in, I think, the 40s, which is in the green zone. It's considered fine. So the bad air that was expected hasn't come, but of course we just don't know when it is going to. It is quite likely that it is going to come over the next 2 weeks, hence why it's been such a talking point.
And I think that's probably a good way to start, really, because that is the prevailing talking point of the tournament. It is the big news story. And what's interesting is we were given, and Simon described this yesterday, an indicator from the organisers here as to what happens when. And if a reading comes in at such and such, and it's all graded and it's colour-coded, then play will stop. Now, Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal both came into the press conference within 15, 20 minutes of one another today, and were really quite open about the player meeting, the ATP player meeting last night that they both attended, and the information that they were given about the air quality rating and the rules, etc. And they also, I suppose, in kind of response to the criticism that they'd had from one of the players, I can't remember which player, it was a Canadian player.
It was Braden Schnurr.
Yeah. Who's one of the qualifiers, I think, or played in the qualifying, and he said something along the lines of Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal should be stepping up more for the interests of players like us.
Mm.
And did he use the word selfish?
He did use the word selfish, which then he put out a statement the next day kind of saying that he thought that word had been picked up on a bit too much, and his wider point was that Federer and Nadal have this platform and they should be thinking of some of the lower ranked players a bit more.
Yeah. Well, Federer came in, and when he was asked about the situation, he said that the moment that all this started happening on Tuesday with the qualifying rounds, when the qualifying tournament began, and the player from Slovenia, whose name I'm forgetting,
Dalila Jakupovic,
when she suffered the way she did, and some of the other players did as well, and there was quite a lot of chat on social media from players complaining about the lack of information they were getting and the fact that they were being sent out and is it dangerous, etc., etc. Federer said, at that point, I went into the organiser's office, the tournament director's office, and said, what's happening? What's the situation? And really, your problem is communication. We don't know what's happening as players. We don't know whether it's when it's safe, when it's not safe, what the guidelines are. You need to communicate better. And he was quite clear on that subject, wasn't he? I was struck by how he wanted to get that over.
Mm. And then Rafael Nadal said virtually the same thing, that he'd also been in the tournament operations office asking that same question. And I think the position now is clearer, because they have released these parameters of when they will play and when they won't play. I think the problem that Federer and Nadal were saying is that they didn't release that in time for the qualifiers, so no one really knew stood with all this.
Nor for the ATP Cup.
Exactly.
So we've had 10 days, 12 days of players just kind of being told, yeah, it's safe. Okay, why is it safe? Well, just because we've consulted people, without being able to give any definitives. And the players, Federer said, the players had been told by staff at the player meeting that at the Olympics there is a a cutoff point of 300, the air quality index of 300. And if it goes above that at the Olympics, that's when they stop. Whereas here at the Australian Open, it's at 200. So they were saying, well, you know, if we're between 2 and 300 as a sort of buffer zone, then we should be pretty content that anything below 200, we are safe to play. And he was, they were, both of them were quite forceful about that. And there was a great moment where, after you, Matt, had listened to the rest of the Nadal press conference, which was in Spanish, which I couldn't understand, but Matt was there sort of smiling knowingly. At the end of it, Matt, you said to me, it's almost as if Federer and Nadal have met beforehand and decided what their story is here.
Yeah, if they were suspects in a... in some kind of trial, and they both came out with those stories, I would be a little suspicious that they were kind of, I don't know, corroborated on them to get their, you know, to get their side of the story so similar. But I'm sure that they'd just experienced the same meeting and had the same discussions with the same people. So they were both talking about the fact that the threshold here was 200 versus 300 at the Olympics. They were both talking about the fact that the communication needed to be better. And they both made the point, Federer in English and Nadal in Spanish, that yes, the smoke was a problem on Tuesday and Wednesday, but can we be completely 100% sure that the retirements and the struggles that the players were feeling were smoke related and not also heat related? Because every year we do see retirements and heat problems at the Australian Open, and this year, obviously, the smoke is the big talking point, but that doesn't mean that the heat problem has gone away. That is still going to be a factor in the next 2 weeks. So if we do see some retirements and the smoke index is less than 200, maybe the point that Nadal and Federer were making is that we shouldn't automatically jump to the conclusion that it is the smoke, because there are other factors that create difficult environments and conditions for the players.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a point well made, actually.
I actually also spoke separately to Dan Evans and asked him whether he felt any effects of what he's experienced over... He's been here throughout the whole of the ATP Cup and he's practiced here. Has he experienced any issue with the conditions himself on a personal level? And he said, I really don't feel I have. I don't feel like I've been affected at all. I know other players feel differently and different players will experience conditions differently.
I think that's exactly it, isn't it? While you were in the Dan Evans press conference, I was in the Stefanos Tsitsipas one, and he had said that he had some breathing difficulties, some lung problems earlier on in the week when he was practicing, because he felt that the smoke was adversely affecting him. So I think some players are just going to react in different ways. They're going to be more sensitive to it.
I also do feel that there is the potential, and I'm not accusing anybody of anything here, but I do feel that there is the potential for a kind of panic to be setting in and players to be almost expecting to feel a certain way because they're hearing about how the conditions are not great, and therefore it can be more pronounced when they do feel anything. I do. That's just human nature.
Psychosomatic in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I just think it's really important that they've got in there now, and they could have saved themselves a lot of headaches over the last 10 days if they'd had this 200 kids cutoff point beforehand. Look, it's easy for me to say. I'm not in charge, and I'm not saying I'd have done all those same things, but in hindsight, and they didn't have that hindsight, I understand that, but we now know, and Federer and Nadal clearly were straight in there making that point. And it shows, I think, kind of the influence that they have, if that's what they did. And I know it's not just down to them, but there were some adverse headlines that probably played a part too.
And it was interesting how irritated Federer was in his press conference by the continued questioning. There was maybe one or two, certainly at least two questions on this issue of the smoke, and in particular the kind of angle that maybe he wasn't doing enough to help the other players. So he was obviously very quick to give his story of going into the tournament director's office.
And he did say, I mean, really, what more do you expect me to do?
Exactly, yeah. It's not like I can go on the court and call it all off. I don't have that sort of influence. So, yeah, he's used his power in the way he thought he could. But it is interesting how annoyed Federer does get by that angle of questioning. You know, image is very important to him, and I can understand that.
Well, I can understand it from a perspective also of a feeling of integrity from himself as well. He doesn't want that questioned.
Yeah.
I think he feels, well, hold on, I've been around for a long time now doing my bit. I don't think you can really call that into question. But it was, by his standards, a bit of a chippy press conference.
Yeah.
I mean, he still gave some great answers. It's a circus, a Roger Federer press conference, particularly here, I think, at the Australian Open. I mean, we sat in all of them, and suddenly we couldn't move.
Yeah, I said, guess who's next?
Yeah.
Because the room was packed.
You looked around you, and at the back, it was just everybody was standing as well. There was not room to move at all. And they couldn't get through many questions at all, because the other thing is Federer gives quite long, detailed answers, and they did draw that press conference to a close quite abruptly, at which point bear in mind, this was Roger Federer's first press conference publicly of the year, so there was a lot to get him on, there was a lot to ask him about, a lot has happened, and he is one of the people that you really want to go to in this scenario. And he said at the end of the press conference, oh, by the way, I'm playing Steve Johnson.
If
anyone cares, I thought that's maybe why I was here to talk about that. As though it was kind of our fault for not asking him about Steve Johnson, his first round opponent, which, okay, I take your point, but these are pressing subjects which we need your view on. And the press conference was called to a halt so swiftly after those subjects had been covered, there wasn't time for anything else. As it happens, they ended up allowing one extra question about it, and he gave a really interesting answer on a couple of levels. One, in as much as the way he talked about Steve Johnson, he knows everything about him. You know, you've got the feeling he knows his shoe size, he's so well prepared. But he also, it showed how he leaves no stone unturned. There's no danger of taking him too lightly.
And that's really interesting, because he used the phrase, Steve Johnson's match ready and I'm not. And yet, for Federer, that doesn't feel like such a huge risk, because he's got, I mean, it is a bit of a risk, but he's got so much experience and so much confidence that I think he knows that he can come out and play a good enough match to beat Steve Johnson in the first round. He talks about having these low expectations.
I know that thing. He actually said that. My expectations are low.
Yeah.
It was all I could do not to sneeze.
Yeah, I almost laughed out loud. I mean, low expectations for a 20-time Grand Slam champion, that just isn't a thing.
I was here in 2017 when he gave a very similar standing press conference.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think there is a definite sense that Federer seemed quite liberated in 2017. He wasn't putting that pressure on himself, but of course he did have expectations that he would do well. And I think if he can come out and play free tennis, that is going to be when he's at his most dangerous.
Yeah.
But obviously he needs to just work his way into the tournament.
One of the things I noticed with Nadal is incidentally, he was given the International Tennis Writers Association Ambassador Award for the year for his cooperation with the media. And he has had a particularly good year with the media. I think he's given some great lines. You talked about it in our end-of-year show. But he wasn't exactly hiding the fact that his physical state is not exactly ideal just at the moment. I mean, you know, he was asked how you doing, and he said, well, hopefully well enough. But I didn't get the feeling that he was that bullish about it all.
No, agreed. I mean, his last tournament ended with him saying, I don't quite have the energy for this, and I've got maybe one or two little niggles. I think Nadal's fitness, as so often with Nadal, is his biggest concern at this tournament, because I do think his tennis, he's playing pretty well. Certainly the back end of last year, ATP Cup, he was a little shaky in a couple of matches. But really, it's all about his physical conditioning, as it so often is. By the way, I was disappointed he received a trophy for that International Writers Award, and he didn't bite it.
I know.
Which, you know, that's his thing.
Is that award not good enough for you,
yeah,
Rafa, or
literally,
what?
Yeah, like, come on. That's the photo we want, Rafa.
Maybe I could bring in my predictions trophy and he can bite that.
Which one?
Well, they're quite.
Did you really pack them? Or was that for social media purposes?
Briefly, for a photo shoot. But anyway.
Nothing's real, folks.
I've been polluted by my brain with all this social media content hashtag. It was interesting. And I'm not that convinced, at the moment at least, about Nadal. And I realised that can be clipped and played in our final episode when he's reached the final and won the whole thing.
It does feel like we were having this conversation last year. I think if we went back to our Australian Open show last year, we probably said exactly the same thing about Nadal, that it was his physical conditioning which is the major factor in all this.
Yeah.
And I think he surprised us last year by how ruthless he was getting to the final.
Yeah.
But I don't quite see him doing that this year. I think the ATP Cup and the Davis Cup last year have taken more out of him than he would have liked.
We had a couple of players into the press conference room that could form his fourth round and quarter final opponents respectively. Nick Kyrgios came in, he was the last one in that we were in with, and then after that Dominic Thiem in the quarter final stages, he also came in. It also interesting for different reasons. I think Kyrgios is continually talking about how he's playing for something bigger than himself here at the Australian Open. If you're not sure what he means by that, he means the effects of the Australian bushfires here. It's affected him so deeply, and he's been the starting point for so many of the initiatives that we've seen raising money for that cause, which is great. I just feel like you do get a bit of an insight into the type of character he is when you sit in a press conference like that with him. He just isn't made like most players. He's not that bothered.
No.
Really.
He kind of sits at a bit of an angle away from the media who are asking him the questions. He occasionally engages you, looks you in the eye, but there's not a lot of really positive body language coming from him.
And yet he's so quick.
He's so sharp.
The analysis, the wit, the taking on board your question, and if he doesn't think much of it, he cuts you down in an instant and makes you look... And he was quite rude at one point with one woman who asked him, in what way are you playing for more than yourself? And he was like, really? You can't work it out? Which was
rude.
A bit unnecessary. Now, I'm sure Catherine would say, well, I don't agree, he does care. And it's not that I don't think he cares, but I think he's very quick to go from caring to putting it in a perspective that maybe other players wouldn't, of, you know, it's only tennis. I mean, who cares? And he has really been harping on about that over the course of this week. But I got the sense that he feels that this whole process, although he hates the effect it's having on people's lives, might end up making him play better.
Yeah, I think he does think that. I mean, he didn't quite say that I play better when I am playing for something bigger than myself, but that's what I took from what he said about
that. And almost just something other than myself.
Yes.
Doesn't even... Give him a... invent a cause.
Yeah.
You know, and I know that he's not doing that with this. I mean, he was at pains to also say, look, I don't care about praise and all that sort of thing. I genuinely care about this. And well, of course, you should care. But at the same time, it's quite heartwarming the degree to which it's affecting him. It's going to be really interesting because he's supposed to play Khachanov, isn't he? Round three. We were just talking with Simon Briggs as we passed him in the corridor about whether we feel that match will happen. Him against Nadal in round four, given that Khachanov could be in the way.
And we were racking our brains to try and think of whether Kyrgios had played Khachanov, and of course they have once, and it was the infamous match which sparked Kyrgios's probation period. It was the one where he verbally abused umpire Fergus Murphy yeah. and crossed the line, to be honest. It was unacceptable.
That's the one where Kyrgios lost me for a period of time, I must say. If I saw that back, I would really struggle to put that behind me.
It was in Cincinnati just a few months ago. And so, I mean, a lot of people have obviously been talking about the Kyrgios-Nadal match looming in the fourth round, but there's a match in the third round, potentially, with a big backstory to it as well.
Yeah. Incidentally, there was he was asked about what Zverev had said as well in the press conference, and Matt and I were looking at each other as if to say, well, what's Zverev said?
What has Zverev said?
I can't remember. And we've looked it up, and it appears to be an interview from a week or so ago, which has only just been put out, where Zverev has said, well, quite honestly, there are better players than Nick Kyrgios around. And he named Tsitsipas as one, he named Alex de Minaur as another, who yeah. obviously can't play.
He really emphasised younger players who are better than Kyrgios now. And as someone wrote in the comments on Twitter, well, there are also some younger players who are better than you, Zverev.
No offence,
yeah.
But, look, you have to say, in terms of the facts of it all, well, Zverev's probably right. I mean, his reasoning was, over the best of five sets, this isn't just a question of go and win in an hour and 20 minutes. You've got to win over the distance. And Kyrgios has so far proven himself unable to do that on a consecutive basis, hence why he hasn't reached a quarter final in years of a slam. But he didn't really bite, did he, Kyrgios?
No. He said, I'm not going to bite at all. Then he had a little nibble, and then sensibly moved on.
Yeah, so then we had Dominic Thiem come in, or shortly before Dominic Thiem came in, and he was talking about the conditions and what else. He gave quite an interesting answer about how he starts seasons slowly. Mm. After an off-season, he finds it hard to get his rhythm and routine. And hence why we've perhaps seen the result, and hence why he plays so much. That's the gist I got from it.
Yeah, well, you asked him, why is he playing all those tournaments in the summer? We're talking about Kitzbühel, Hamburg and Gstaad, which he's committed to playing already.
All on clay. I said to him, in between Wimbledon and the US Open, I got the sense he didn't particularly like that. I drew my attention to him in that way, but because he gave one answer at the end when he was describing why he's playing Stade. He says, and by the way, Stade is a freaking great tournament if you've never been there. Well, actually, I have been there about 10 times, Dominic, and I agree with you. It's a wonderful tournament. I just question how relevant it is to a top player trying to win the US Open.
And he seemed to suggest that last year when he played Kitzbühel and then had a week off, that adversely affected him going into Montreal and the US hardcourt swing. So therefore, he's added in an extra week of tennis because he thinks that will help him. Which, you know, it might, but I can't escape the fact that he's not playing the Olympics and he's choosing to play those three tournaments instead.
I wish I'd pushed that issue, actually.
I just think, you know, Kitzbühel is going to happen every year. That's not going anywhere on the calendar.
But he means the world to him.
It does.
I do have respect for that. And I also remember how Catherine described his appearance in Toronto last year, coming off the back of that, and what a state he was in.
Mm. I suppose it's positive that he is looking for solutions to that problem. He's not just going to do the same thing again. Now, yeah. Our solution in our mind is probably different to the one that he's come up with, but you know, I'm sure he knows better than us, so he's doing what he's doing, and we will come back later on in the year and see how that all works out. But he does look like he's been on a lad's holiday, doesn't he, team, with his blonde highlights and his sort of unshaven look at the
he's
moment
been drafted into a boy band
it's quite a look.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, tennis podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. We started the press conference day with Daniil Medvedev at about 12 o'clock, about 5 hours ago, and We both asked him quite a few questions before I figured out that I'm supposed to put my hand up before I ask questions, and I got a royal telling off.
you got admonished.
Yeah, I did. We had three press conferences where I was asking like loads of questions, and I didn't realise there were loads of other journalists giving me daggers because apparently I was taking their place every time.
You're meant
sorry,
to put
colleagues.
Your hand up, David.
Yes. So anyway, I got a lovely chat with Daniil Medvedev, Caroline Wozniacki, and Naomi Osaka before I got reined in. But Medvedev, I felt we both came out of that going, what an impressive guy he is. What a nice bloke he sounds for a start. He really engages you, doesn't he? First of all, he came in, he said, hello, how you doing? You know, and he was really nice to everybody. And in terms of just the way he answers questions, he just looks you in the eye and takes in what you're asking him and gives whatever answer he feels.
I'm trying to think if there is a player on the tour, on either tours at the moment, who there's a bigger contrast between their on-court personality and their press room personality, because you know, it's just over a week ago, maybe less. Time's a bit weird at the moment, but it was about a week ago at the ATP Cup where he was, you know, slamming his racket on the umpire's chair and getting in a war of words with nicest man in the world, Diego Schwartzman. And then he comes into the press conference and he couldn't be more charming.
No.
It is just an extraordinary contrast. But I thought it was really interesting. A journalist asked him whether he was worried at all that last year that he'd peaked. He kind of said, yeah.
He said, well, actually, I have been worried about that.
Yeah. You know, which kind of went back to our discussions about, you know, whether it was a hot streak that he was on last summer.
Yeah, I mean, I think our discussion with Catherine and her brother was... Catherine has been absolutely bowled over by Daniil Medvedev over the last 3 or 4 months, as you know. And not only am I hugely impressed with his tennis, but just loves everything about his completely aggro personality. And I just sort of threw it out there that this might just be a hot streak.
Mm.
This might be... He might never do this again. And the corporate side of the business might advise him that it's not that good an idea to fall out with everybody, and we'll just be left with the memories and the metronomic winning of titles, and maybe not even the metronomic winning of titles if it's just a hot streak.
Mm.
And he kind of made you feel that he's also worried about that, because he doesn't know whether that 2 or 3 month spell around the summer of last year is his baseline level and normality, or whether that was the aberration.
Mm. I mean, it was the fact that he did it in, what was it? Was it 6 consecutive finals he reached? That to me took it beyond hot streak, I kind of thought. It felt like he'd cracked something. It felt like he was here. He'd arrived. And, you know, I kind of think a hot streak's maybe 1 or 2 weeks, but he was beating everyone apart from Nadal, and we just hadn't seen that before from anyone. But then I asked him today whether he felt like he had recovered from the... I think the words I used was loss of momentum that he felt at the end of last season, because I think that's what he'd said at the ATP Finals. And he used the word burnout, that he had completely burned himself out last season and just couldn't play the Davis Cup at the end of the year, couldn't give his best at the ATP Finals. And yet now, just... he does feel like he's been invigorated again, and he's got his energy back, and he's got his sort of swagger back a little bit.
I found his demeanour very convincing in that press conference.
Yeah.
And to me, the fact that he was prepared to engage the idea publicly that he also was concerned that this might have just been a bit of a one-off made me feel like, no, it's not.
Mm.
You know, he knows himself. He's a really intelligent guy. Daniil Medvedev is my sense, and he knows that he's got the game to contend. He also gives you this feeling that he doesn't have any sort of imposter syndrome with those other top players now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think being around them at the ATP Finals was probably quite important for him. He did say that he would be satisfied with quarterfinals.
Well, he was asked, would you be satisfied with? And he ummed and ahed, and he said, you know, well, winning the tournament. And he said, I mean, I suppose if I got to the quarterfinals, but I got the sense that, no, you wouldn't.
Yeah, I kind of thought if other players had been saying that, my alarm bells would have been ringing. But with him, they didn't really.
No, he was just being polite enough
To answer the question.
Answer the question, but he has lofty hopes of himself here. He also said that the day after, I asked him whether his life has changed since reaching that US Open final in terms of getting recognised. And he said the day after in New York, he said, I wore a hoodie, and he said, I looked in the mirror and I was wearing so much stuff that I didn't even recognise myself. And yet people were still recognising me. And I was like, how are they doing this?
Well, he was doing his own impact on the people of New York a disservice. He was ingrained in everyone's mind during that US Open, the way he behaved towards them.
Yeah. So that was Daniil Medvedev. He was followed into the interview room by Caroline Wozniacki, who is going to retire after the Australian Open here, and she was dressed up to the nines. She looked like she was about to go out and go to a gala dinner or something, because she'd got her very, very expensive looking jewellery and manicure, blue fingernails, all the rest of it, and just looked so sort of happy to have made the decision she's made. You get the feeling that is not something that has been made off the cuff. She has thought that through and calculated, how do I want to finish my career? It feels right now, I'm ready.
Oh, completely. She is so at peace with her decision. It just feels like the right time. It feels like, you know, to be blunt and truthful about it, she was not becoming a better tennis player in the last year, 18 months. She'd already achieved everything and more than she'd ever set out to achieve. You know, we were talking about her as... she is a bit of a contrast in a way, because she does come into an interview room and there is this kind of sense of self-importance about her a little bit, and she is all done up, you know, completely. And yet, on the court, she is one of the fiercest competitors we've seen over the last decade, and has squeezed absolutely everything out of herself. And those two personality traits don't necessarily always marry up with one another, but with her, they're both a big part of what makes her her.
Yeah, I mean, she is on the court, she is tough as old boots.
Yeah,
doesn't matter what you throw at her, she will keep coming back for more. And she might get hit off the court. She was quite interesting talking about Kim Clijsters. It was one of our Belgian colleagues who was asking literally every single tennis player who came in about the return of Kim Clijsters and how it might go.
I absolutely loved the way he framed his question every time. He had a little angle specific to each player, and then he thought, hang on a minute, this is the Kim Clijsters question.
You're in your late 30s. Somebody else who's in their late 30s is about
you
to come
admired
out.
Kim Clijsters when you were growing up.
Yes. But she was actually I mean, she was pretty blunt in her assessment, Wozniacki, that Clijsters is going to find it really hard.
Yeah.
And the reason is the game has moved on. Everybody's stronger, fitter, taller, hits the ball harder. And, you know, she's had injuries and I'm not sure the body's going to stand that. And she wasn't trying to be rude or negative. She was being honest. But it's kids' day today, folks, which is why you're hearing a little lad who's playing with a ball with his mate in the fountain and shouting and getting really excited.
If there's one thing Catherine is kind of pleased to have missed, it's kids' day.
Which has been fantastic.
I must say, walking in, I was completely wowed by it. I mean, the sheer number of activities they have going on. There's zip wires. There's a blooming water park over by the entrance. I mean, it really is amazing.
Magnificent. But just getting back to Wozniacki, I said to you as well that the one thing that really occurred to me is that she's seen her in a press conference, which is where a lot of my memories come from of Caroline Wozniacki, is what a magnificently bad loser she is. And the number of times I've seen her lose a match and just say something really snarky and slightly rude about the player that's just beaten her, or about some decision the organisers have taken, or how it's not fair. And
I remember, I think she lost to Makarova, I think it was, at Wimbledon last year, maybe a couple of years ago, 2018, I think it was. And she was asked whether she thinks Makarova will go far in the tournament. She said, no, not really. I don't think she played very well. I just don't think I played very well.
Yeah.
But, you know, just love that. Because most players would trot out, oh, yeah, they played really well and they're going to go far in this tournament. You know, better player won on the day. But she wasn't having any of it.
And I don't mind
that. No, I don't mind that at all.
I mean, for a start, as a journalist, it's just so much fun to listen to these slightly blunt, whingy answers where she's just not holding anything back through politeness.
Yeah.
And look, as you say, she has wrung out every drop out of her career. And I think she should be... Well, look, she is very proud of herself. You can see she's absolutely glowing about how good she's... How well she's done. And fair enough.
Yeah, she should be. I think if you look purely at her game, you wouldn't say that is... a Grand Slam champion, what, two other Grand Slam finals and a world number one for, I think, something like 70 weeks, like that.
She first became world number one in 2009, 10 years ago. She won her first Grand Slam title 2 years ago, which I find pretty astounding, given the way, as she described about Clijsters, the game has moved on, and her game... doesn't really match up power-wise. There was that period where she was world number one and she was winning matches without hitting a single winner. Do you remember there were those stats going around? And she managed to inject a little bit into her game to enable her to have some teeth.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people spun that really negatively. It was kind of like, well, how can you be number one, you know, without the weapons, without that game? But actually, really, it was a tremendous... it was a tremendous validation of everything she was doing on the tennis court, that she was maximising herself to be world number one. It'd be like David Ferrer being number one, which you kind of would think, well, that wouldn't happen, but Wozniacki was, and you know, it was amazing. And I was looking up, do you know where she is on the all-time money list in women's tennis?
No.
Fourth.
Blimey.
She's behind the Williams sisters and Maria Sharapova.
Head of Azarenka.
Yeah. So it's likely that someone like Halep might overtake her maybe this year. It's pretty close. But yeah, she's fourth on the all-time money list, Caroline Wozniacki. I mean, I know that's... Obviously, there's been a lot of inflated prize money and, you know, she's been kind of fortunate to be playing in this era with increased prize money. But still, I mean, that is a remarkable kind of... body of work she's put together.
Yeah, it is. She was followed into the interview room and pretty much finally, really, Naomi Osaka, who's kind of the other end of the spectrum in terms of career. She's obviously won two Grand Slam titles. She comes in as the defending champion. And in the sort of 10 to 15 minutes she was in the interview room, I went through so many different emotions and feelings. And I really didn't know... I didn't come in with any preconceptions. I'd kind of forgotten what a Naomi Osaka press conference could be like, partly because over the last year I've felt she has not looked that happy in some of the press conferences she's attended and not really been the person that I kind of remember. This was a return to what I remember, and yet there was a load of candor about what she's been through over the past 12 months. And to describe the emotions that I went through, to use Simon's words of yesterday, there was moments where I feel incredibly awkward and uncomfortable, and there are silences which she just sort of leaves hanging, and you're like, oh my goodness, I'm cringing here. But yet she's utterly delightful and charming and quirky and funny and engaging in other ways.
Oh, absolutely. And I think she said that last year was the most difficult year of her life, and you really did feel that in a lot of her press conferences. As you said, there was a sadness that came over her, and I think also she found it difficult to accept the fact that she maybe thought she was backing up her Australian Open and US Open win by doing pretty well, really. You know, she did have her best ever clay court swing, and you know, a lot of the time all that she heard was that she wasn't doing well.
Yeah, crashed out and all that sort of thing.
Exactly. And you know, she said that I think she said to you today that she now tries to ignore some of the articles a little bit more that are written about
it. This was the press conference where I still didn't know I was supposed to put up my hand. And virtually every answer she gave, I gave a little follow-up just trying to getting her to expand. Apparently I shouldn't have been doing that. But anyway, it ended up being quite a good press conference as a result, felt. And at one point she said, I don't really have a rivalry. I haven't been around long enough for that, and I kind of feel a rivalry would be a blessing. And I wanted to know what you mean by blessing. And she said, well, it's just really cool, isn't it, if you can be a Nadal fan or in the rivalry or something. You know, you get two people who are playing each other quite a lot, and they're always tough matches. And then I was really grateful to one of our colleagues who then said, well, who would you like to have as a rival? And that question just hung in the air for what seemed like forever as she just sat there in silence mulling this over.
It was agonising because there was a name that I think I was thinking. I think other people were thinking it. You were clearly thinking it because after about, I mean, it could have been 30 seconds of pretty much silence or, ooh, I don't know.
Well, she asked
what
us
do you
then,
think?
Didn't she?
Yeah, what do you think?
She said, well, you know, I kind of feel like this should be an audience thing, so what do you lot think?
And then there was a silence, and then you just came out with...
Well, what about Bianca Andreescu? Wouldn't she be a good rival for you? Because she said, Osaka said, I kind of feel like rivals should be total opposites.
Yeah.
What's the opposite of me? To me, well, Andreescu is the opposite of you.
Yeah.
She's full of the joy. She doesn't question anything, it feels like. And she's got this game full of variety and cat and mouse as well as the power. And she said, yeah, I think that would be quite good.
Although she did say that she found the match she played against Andreescu really tough, and she's not kind of looking forward to the next one. But I think the point about having a rival for why Osaka as well might think it's a good thing to have is if you have a rival, you are at the top of the game. You know, we don't talk about rivalries between players who are, you know, outside the top 10, really. I mean, a little bit, depending on the kind of matches that they have. But the rivalries you talk about are the ones that sustain the sport in a way and draw our attention, get us all talking. And I think she realises the power of that, and she wants part of it. And I like the fact that she's talking like that.
Yeah, and I think also a rivalry would give a good yardstick for where she is. Something to say. It's a bit like having a target at the net, isn't it? You've got a corridor to go down, and you can just concentrate on that. I think she likes to keep it relatively simple because I think she's probably automatically a pretty macro person. She's sitting there thinking about the wider sphere, and she's not that good at the tunnel vision bit of just winning the next point. And she actually gave a really good insight into what it has been like coming back as the defending champ. And she said, I feel like maybe I'm not as fearless as I was. I'm aware of the consequences of shots. I know what it feels like now to have to fight really, really hard for a long period of time to win these matches, and I know how much that's going to hurt sometimes, so I'm more aware and therefore less fearless.
I always think she's so reflective. I always think that every experience she has, she tries to take something from it and learn from it. Now, she might not be able to do it better next time, but she has at least got the knowledge of what in theory she thinks she needs to do. She used an analogy in the Japanese portion of her press conference. Not that I speak Japanese, but she gets the questions in Japanese and answers in English, so it's always worth staying for that portion. And she said it's like going on a hike. And last year she was kind of going on the hike without knowing the route, and she just did it. Now she's got to do the same hike again, and she knows the route, she knows the ups and downs. Doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be any easier, but she's got more knowledge now, and maybe she'll be able to tread her path.
The first
better.
Round is massively important in her mind, isn't it? Because she's really worried about these 2,000 points she's got to defend. She's really worried about the fact that she's going to go outside the world's top 10 if she doesn't win the first round.
And there was another interesting insight there, I thought, the way kind of quite bullishly for Asar, because she said, I know that if I play my best, I'm not going to lose that match. And when she came out with that, I thought, well, yeah. But
I can't remember who she's playing.
No, I can't.
Not to worry.
Buzkova. I think it might be Buzkova.
We'll talk about that tomorrow. Tomorrow's draw show.
So, you know, so often she will give her opponents a lot of respect, a lot of credit. And I'm not saying that she isn't. But to come out with a statement like that was not something I'd heard from her before, I don't think.
I think she looks another one to me that's in a pretty good place. I think she can have a good tournament here.
I think so.
She seems very settled with Wim Fassett, her new coach. So it's going to be fascinating. Really is. The only other press conference I went to, I mentioned briefly, was Dan Evans. There was a very funny line come out about, you may have been reading about how Tim Henman said he could probably miss a few meals, which I've heard Henman say about people before. And a little jibe at how Dan Evans maybe could lose a bit of weight. And Evans was ready for this. He clearly had an absolute ball in the ATP Cup team. He was at pains to stress how much he'd enjoyed Henman's company. And he said, to be honest, I wasn't very surprised. Tim doesn't give many compliments. and it sounds as though they've had a lot of fun on the sort of group chat between them all, and everybody's been given Evans' stick. And he said, look, fact is, I've got a different body type to these rakes like Henman, Salisbury and Murray. He said, to be honest, I'm not that bad. He said, I don't mind a fizzy drink. I don't mind a bit of alcohol. But, you know, generally. he actually said he'd gone vegan for a while after the US Open until the end of the year. And then he just gave up. he said, I think I did a test of my, you know, what's in my body, and it was clear that I probably needed to have some meat again, so I did.
I'm going to say, I can believe the giving up part.
Yeah. But I don't know. I get another one that I just sense is really bullish about what's to come. He's certainly going to play his own game, but he also did reference a little bit of the Osakas again about how it's slightly different now, because he said when I was in... was it Adelaide last week? He said, I was playing matches that I felt like I'm supposed to win. You know?
Okay.
And I got this sense of, well, what's it going to be like if I don't win this one? Because on rankings, I'm supposed to.
Right.
So it's a different mentality. Mm. But generally, I think he seems really positive and British number one, and really is probably, given that Konta doesn't appear fully fit, maybe the one who's expected to do the best here from British perspective.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think Kyle Edmund...
depends if he gets on a roll, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Edmund probably has a higher ceiling.
Agreed.
Who knows how well he's going to play.
Mm.
Anything else?
Well, just while you were in the Evans, I went to Tsitsipas, which I touched on. He wasn't kind of giving those answers where he just allows his mind to wander and go places where no one knows where it's going to go.
Is that good or bad?
Well, I was disappointed.
I know you were disappointed, but do you think it's good or bad for him? That's an unknown.
I don't... I don't think it makes that much difference, really. He wasn't... I mean, comparing him to a year ago, I think it was clear how much he's grown into his role now at the top of the game. Last year, he was completely starry-eyed about the whole Melbourne experience. He used the phrase today that he was living the dream. And it felt like that every time you went to a press conference or watched one of his matches. It kind of all felt a bit unbelievable, the kind of level of support he was having and what he was producing tennis-wise. Now, I think everyone's expecting him to do that again,
yeah,
himself included. So that was a slight shift, I think. He mentioned about how he'd had... the tantrum was the word he used at the ATP Cup, and how he was embarrassed about it because he says, talking like some kind of Jedi out of Star Wars, that he's found some balance within himself, and that was the kind of moment of madness. So again, he's another one like Osaka, who I think is really reflective and takes things good or bad from stuff they've done and tries to improve on it. So I think he's in a good place, but he wasn't kind of mystic about the whole thing like he so often is.
How disappointing. Let's hope the mystical side of Stefanos Tsitsipas is back before we know it. And we will be back before you know it, because we're going to be here every single day of the Australian Open with editions of the Tennis Podcast, kick-started by your very good selves. There is less than 2 days to go now and a handful of hours. If you haven't backed us and you would like to do so, you'll get your name on our backers page on the website. If you want to chip in 100 quid, you'll get a shout out, which is what Pete McMarris, Eleanor Hawkins and Michelle Kihu, I believe it is correctly pronounced, and if it's not, do let me know, Michelle, have all done. So thank all of you, Pete, Eleanor and Michelle, for backing the Tennis Podcast, because that's how we've been able to fly Matt over to Melbourne and put him up for the next couple of weeks. It's how Catherine is hopefully going to arrive in a couple of days' time. That, you know, this is where the money's going, and we're hugely grateful and appreciative of the fact that so many people have supported us, and that this show means enough to you to frankly put your money where your mouth is. It's fantastic, and we can't thank you enough. So just about 35 hours as I come to you right now in Garden Square on Saturday evening to go in our Kickstarter. If you scan down on your show notes, you'll be able to click the link and back us. You can also, whilst there, you can sign up for our newsletter, which is going to be going out every day over the course of the tournament. It'll include Matt's stat, and it'll include daily predictions where Matt, Catherine and myself take on Melanie Bowes, our 2017 champion in the year-long prediction. She is going to take us on in the dailies. You ready, Matt?
Slightly concerned that we're going to get exposed.
As per.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I mean, Catherine and I are up against
two champions,
yeah.
Current reigning holder, me. We have our mascots, Butler, and for the year, and Crumble, the Australian Open mascot. And if you haven't seen these dogs, go to our Instagram page, because they are just worth the admission price. There isn't any admission price, but if there was, it'd be worth it.
I think I may have got Crumble's gender wrong yesterday.
Well, not to worry. Sorry, Crumble. And there's also Ian's Reddit page, which you can have a look at and chat all things tennis and all things Tennis Podcast.
And I went on the Reddit page this morning, just thought I'd have a look, and... Oh, yeah. Someone had started a thread saying that they were disappointed in me.
Oh, yeah.
Because I hadn't acknowledged the fact when you and Simon were talking about it yesterday and weren't really sure what it is. That it has a very strong tennis connection.
Oh, yeah.
In that it was founded, set up by Serena's husband.
Oh, yeah.
So it's kind of, its roots are tennis related.
Well, there you go. What more reason do you need?
And I have a question for the Reddit community.
Oh, yeah.
I want to know why Radu Albot is a big thing on Reddit. Because he is. He's like the player that they have kind of adopted, and he does the ask me anythings and that kind of thing, and they kind of follow his results, and he's their guy on Reddit. And I want to know what the source of that is. So the people of Reddit... on the tennis podcast subreddit, I will be looking tomorrow. So can, please answer that for me.
I can just imagine my mother's face listening to this bit of the show. And what are they talking about? Anyway, let us know, Radu Albot fans on Reddit. What's all that about? We have been the Tennis Podcast, and we will be back every single day throughout the Australian Open, including tomorrow when we are going to go through the draws with a fine-tooth comb, and we're going to make our predictions for this tournament. I'm ready too. Can't wait. See you tomorrow.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.